Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Jay Dyer. Jay returns to the show. Jay, how you doing?
Great, Tim. Always glad to be on Our Interesting Times because these times, ours, they are ours and they are interesting.
Yes. It's a curse. Great. Listen.
Things are looking up, though. Things are looking a little better, in my view.
Yes. There's a glimmer of hope. There's some light out there to contrast the darkness. Now, of course, you are the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. You provide articles, videos, talks, movie reviews, analysis, and, of course, you can get the full complement of your work if you subscribe to it, $60 a month, which I hardly endorse.
A year. $60 a year and $4.95 a month. It's okay.
I'm sorry. $60 a year. Yeah, you destroy your business there. $60 a year.
1.3 million euros or 65 billion pesos a year.
Well, you can, if you said $60 a month, people are like, that must be really good. I got to get that. And also, of course, you are the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film, a book that I heartily recommend, too. I had the pleasure of reading it. Of course, we discussed that book earlier. I guess late last year we talked about that. And, mm-hmm. I think, a book that's relevant. It might be relevant to our talk tonight. Because what we'll be talking about will be perception management, and Hollywood's a big part of that. And
I
do think that these days that the news media, mainstream media, the legacy media, is hard to distinguish from Hollywood. So,
absolutely, yeah.
Now, you recently did a video, Chris. This was, I think you recorded it, or I think it was posted sometime in December. Syria assassinations, WikiLeaks, and the West: the big plan exposed. It's sort of this holistic examination of what's going on in the world. You brought up the Syria, the proxy war, ISIS, and what's going on in Europe, and how this plays into maybe the financial markets, the black markets, the drug trade, human trafficking, even this Pizzagate thing that popped up last fall. So mm-hmm. How do you want to get into it? How do you want to approach this first thing?
Right, well... Yeah, I've been doing a lot more research and really trying to educate myself on the Syria situation, because I certainly don't in any way count myself an expert, but I have been doing a lot of research on that the last couple of years, and writing with Patrick and other people that I have a lot of respect for at 21st Century Wire, like Vanessa Bealey, who I think has actual journalism work that she's done to her credit and has actually done some damage. I think she's gotten a lot of attacks from the pro-war left, right, and this sort of the Obama, Hillary Clinton-style left, as well as Eva Bartlett, who Patrick has done interviews with, and a lot of the accusations that we're all just Russian info war and we're all Russian agents, which is preposterous. So different people have been saying that this week, but I think that shows the ability and quality of those people to, cause damage. And they really are causing damage, because you're getting mainstream Western outlets attacking these people. So that, I think, speaks to their work. So I kind of am learning from their work, trying to build on their work, doing my own research, other books that I read on my own about the Middle East. So it's a very complex subject, but I think that the main point that we need to understand is the different models of regime change. And so this is what I first started realizing the more I dug into this, was that if you look back to the Arab Spring and the pretty much open admissions of the Western support for the Arab Spring, including a lot of the news organizations, like Fox News, for example, would support the idea of this supporting jihad in Libya and in Tunisia. So you have these beginning sort of rumblings of what would spill over into Syria with Libya. Now, before I go into all that, one of the things that struck me as I was reading about, say, Iran-Contra, and when I was reading about the Phoenix Program, I heard your talk with Doug Valentine. I thought that was excellent. I actually got his book for Christmas. So I was starting to dig into that a little bit, and you start to notice that the idea occurred to me, and I was bouncing this idea off of Patrick too, and he thought so as well, that if you go back to these death squads of, say, Iran and Central Latin America that the CIA supported and trained for the paramilitary units and so forth. And if you look back to the death squads of Phoenix program in Vietnam, you start to see these patterns. And so what I think probably was happening was that you were getting research being done simultaneously with these operations being run on how to conduct and effectively cause regime change and cause large-scale social engineering, right? So all those sort of tied together. Now, that's not to say that the nationalist-minded or secular-minded or Soviet-minded individuals in these different states during the Cold War were, quote, good. It's just to say that when a corporation or a Rockefeller institution or an oil entity connected to the Rockefellers or whatever wanted a regime change for business purposes, this is how they would start doing it, especially during the Cold War. So I think this technique was perfected during the Cold War, and it utilizes a bunch of different styles of warfare. And so the interview that I did with Andrew Karibko, I think, went really well. And I read his book and another ebook on this topic, and it really starts to put the puzzle pieces together. And if you're not familiar with the Middle East, you know, that's understandable. Again, it's a very complex, very long history, very difficult topic, but I think you really can begin to put these pieces together. And it starts, I think, with looking at operations like how they would run death squads, how they would do Phoenix program, and what those operations were useful for in terms of long-term regime change methods and strategies and techniques. So then we fast forward to modern day, and what we learn is that a lot of these techniques have been tied into public reports and documentation on things like swarming. So the RAND Corporation has this whole document where they talked about the methods of, they call it utilizing swarming adolescents. That's what they call it. And this is a technique where you do rent-a-mobs or create-a-mob. Now, there's a public RAND paper, RAND Corporation paper. This is not a conspiracy theory. Now, this is what ties into what Andrew Karibko talks about in his book called Asymmetrical Warfare. So what they'll do is, utilizing Twitter, utilizing hashtags, utilizing these sort of marketed human rights activist revolutions, they will recruit these people ahead of time. You know, so an NGO, one of these entities, will go into a country way ahead of time. Money will be allocated, oftentimes openly, publicly. For example, the Syria situation, money was being allocated under the Bush regime for the removal of Assad. All the way back in 2005 was the first that I found so far referenced link to money being allocated to removing Assad.
And so that's when Assad was an official partner in the war on terror, correct?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think Gaddafi as well participated in that for a period. You know, he tried to make these deals with the West as well. Now, these just happen to be, of course, resource-rich regions, especially Libya, which we will get into here in a minute, because none other than Mrs. Hillary Clinton herself wrote op-ed pieces about why Assad needed to be removed. And lo and behold, if you followed the pretty interesting videos that the George Webb guy has been doing on YouTube, where he talks about where is Eric Braverman. Mm-hmm. And he's done like 30 of these. Now, I think he tends to believe a little more is real than I do, but he is sketching out some very interesting connections. And one of those is that he poses the thesis that the Hillary campaign was funneling money, basically selling off kickbacks for what you would get when she achieved the regime change, right? So if you donated to the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's campaign, basically, you know, say you put $1 million in, well, when I move into Libya, we're going to give you a cut of, you know, what we divvy up there. So that's it, and that makes a lot of sense, especially when you go back and in Tony Cartolucci's book, which I do recommend, even though it's dated, it's actually a free ebook. It's called War on Syria, Gateway to World War III, just a free PDF you can find. It's really, really good, though. It's heavily, heavily documented. It lays it all out. So I want to give credit to Tony Cartolucci for what he's written, and then Brandon Turbeville's book, on Syria, which is also like a $3 ebook, a Kindle book, which is really good as well. So reading those two in tandem, I think, can give you a good background of what we're seeing here. And then when we start to think about the older models of, as I said, the excuse me, the regime change through black ops and death squads from the 50s and 60s and so forth, 70s and 80s, you start to see all of these things are not, they're connected in the sense that these NGOs and think tanks have for decades been studying the techniques of regime change and how to most effectively do it. And then, of course, how to use the internet to interact with this. And this is where we get the Arab Spring and the hashtag revolutions. And you even had Eric Schmidt, or one of the, not Eric Schmidt, but one of the Google tech guys bragging about how the Arab Spring would not have been successful, the removal of Mubarak, without Twitter and Google participating in helping that to go forward. And again, it doesn't mean that the people in power were good guys. It just means that this is the technique, the technology of how they're doing it. Now, you go and you look at the Gene Sharp, who I've talked about many times at the Albert Einstein Institute, red flag there, who is a Princeton professor who specializes in the technology of how to achieve, quote, democratic revolution. You watch this 3-minute video with this guy, and excuse my language, you've got these generals who come on, and they're like, some people have said we're part of the CIA, and I say, F you! I'm not joking. You watch that 3-minute video about color revolutions and Gene Sharp. It's a popular video on YouTube. And Gene Sharp comes on, and he says, yes, I've been a professor for many years, studying the technique of democratic revolutions and regime change. And once you understand all of this stuff that we're talking about, you're going to immediately look at that and you see right through that. This is not democratic revolutions in these countries. This is removing people that are no longer amenable to Washington and banker corporate interests. And then that's what it amounts to.
Yeah, their shelf life has expired.
Exactly. Yeah. And now, so when we go back to 2011, lo and behold, I couldn't believe when I was reading this. The Brookings Institute wrote a famous paper, and the paper is called Libya's Test of the New International Order. And in February of 2011, they say, we're going to remove Gaddafi and divvy up the resources. So here you go. I mean, so you start to realize this, you go and read these actual documents, you realize that the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, which is all these PNAC, neocons, McCain, and these Lindsey Graham, and these characters, they put out these documents. They put out these white papers. They put out the foreign policy signals of what they're going to do, and they even hint at, Gaddafi has amassed resources that he's hoarding, and they've got to be divvied up for the international community. Right? In other words, the New World Order. Right. So it's not fair what Gaddafi's doing, and he's not fair. We're going to make it fair when we'll come in and take those resources and make sure that they're allocated fairly.
I haven't gotten my dividend yet.
Yeah, I haven't either. It's interesting. And isn't it interesting, too, that who do we think is paying for these black ops in Syria? Well, the U.S. taxpayer. Tony Cartolucci has documented that. So we're actually paying for all this stuff in these foreign operations.
Yeah, when Reagan, I think he's the one that created the National Endowment for Democracy in 1984. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was described as it's going to do what the CIA used to do in secret. Pretty much.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, yeah, those are just basically sort of CIA fronts. Absolutely. And I didn't know this, actually. This was a new one to me. I don't know the whole background on this, but Tony Cartolucci references this as another example. But in 2010, they did a similar operation where the Thai military attempted to disperse these red shirt supporters of a billionaire telecom tycoon that the CIA wanted to get out of power. And so what they did was they used this, quote, democracy movement. And the military implored the use of water cannons, rubber bullets, and so forth. And so what happened is these black ops squads were there, and they were provoking and provocateuring and, things like shooting the police. And then when the police respond to that, crack down, activate your media people, right? they're cracking down on Democratic protesters, right? Which, in other words, was sparked by provocateurs and we
saw that
snipers.
We saw that in the Ukraine, right?
This is exactly what I was going to say, right? So they had mystery gunmen, rooftop snipers, right, who are up there. The snipers will snipe a cop or two working for the government forces. Government forces respond by cracking down on who it might be and the quote, protesters, all of which has been organized as a giant media event to make the existing regime look like they're tyrants. Now, the existing regime may be tyrants, but the problem is that the bigger tyrant wants to get rid of a smaller tyrant, right? And so that's how this works. And this was, again, the Bangkok, Thailand revolution or regime change, excuse me, of April 2010. So props to Tony Cartolucci for remembering and pointing that one out. And as you said, we see the same model in Ukraine when we have the removal of the existing Russian-friendly government there, and then the importation of they call him Poroshenko, and he like a porn mogul or something like this, like the guy who's running it now. But so yeah, so this model of the CIA military cheap dip black ops sniper guys, it seems to be a repeating model. I think Global Research has an older article I've referenced where they list several of the cases where the sniper story, right? Who knows what the real story is in the midst of all this chaos of protesters and people throwing cocktails or glass bottles or whatever. And, you know, who knows what the real story is. But so what happens is this leads to, you basically get this basic model of control chaos, which is implemented by design by foreign power, usually Western powers, intelligence agencies, so forth. This causes the problems for the existing regime, the existing government, when they respond, problem action, problem reaction solution, right? The government responds in some way. This then allows Western media, essentially all connected as well into the CIA, to run the stories. Wolf Blitzer comes on and says, you know, Colonel Gaddafi, the brutal tyrant killing his own people. And so you get then the response. Brookings writes a paper on Syria in 2011. Time for regime change for Assad. Assad must go, is what John Kerry says, right? NATO enacts a no-fly zone in 2011. This means that NATO is going to start bombing Syria. And they just lie. They just bomb it, and they'll say, whenever they do have a bombing campaign, they'll say Assad has killed his own people. So that model of Assad has killed his own people, Assad is doing this, it's all the opposite, right? And again, I don't have any particular interest in the Ba'athist Party. And as I pointed out many times in interviews, you know, if you read Miles Copeland's book, the Ba'athist Party was set up by the CIA back in that older 40s model where the CIA was much more amenable to Arab nationalism. And they would try to work with Nasser, they would try to work with the Ba'athists. This is where you get Saddam being trained by the CIA and put in as a Ba'athist. But that all expired, right? And whatever happened between the CIA in the 50s to the time of, you know, Brzezinski and this more neocon model, more overtly neoconservative model, where they just said, let's just use the British imperial model of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's where you get. And I'm not an expert on all that, but you know, you read Golden Fitzgerald's book's really good on sort of charting that transition. So they don't use that older Arab nationalist model anymore, and that's why these Assad or Saddam type regimes needed to go. They really wanted to move the more Salafist, Wahhabist, Al Qaeda type groups in, put those in power, and this is where we get those pictures from a few years ago of, you know, John McCain like flies over there and meets with General Idris Salim, I think is his name. And he just sits there and takes pictures with this, you know, quote, Free Syrian Army / Al Qaeda / Al Nusra guy. And he's just sitting there taking pictures with him, and nobody cares. Nobody puts the pieces together that obviously these are the people who are the quote, jihad, but they're really just mercenaries. They're just people that are, as Cartolucci reports, just being recruited into fighting for, you know, the anti-Syrian movement. You get $450 a month and three meals, right?
Yeah.
So that's how that works. Then you get John Bolton comes on and says, this is an axis of evil. And, you know, again, going back to the allocation of funding, even under W. So this is a long, this is where we have proof that Newsweek, even back in the 2000s, was reporting about how the black operations that were run in Iraq, they even say in some of these Newsweek articles back then that they're going to use perhaps some of those same operations in Syria. Very, very old Newsweek articles even then were hinting that the transition would be, you know, to moving to moving Al-Qaeda or quote ISIS, what would become ISIS, out of Iraq and out of Libya, then into Syria. Mm-hmm. And that's where Turkey comes in. Turkey plays the central role of being the next door neighbor right north of Syria, where all of this started rolling in. And that's why Erdogan is, you know, a pretty scandalous figure and has been at the heart of this, because I do buy the argument that what Turkey wants is to be the regional power there, right? And that's why they're generally speaking on the side of NATO. So the Muslim Brotherhood is who's behind the Free Syrian Army. It's a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood support. And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is an older British intelligence operation, long infiltrated and aided by British intelligence and Western power, tied into Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, right, all these Gulf states. And why is it that the Muslim Brotherhood has so many key mosques in London? Why is that? Why is London such a hub for so many of these so-called radical preachers, right? Aswat and the blind sheikh and all these goofball characters who are obviously an admitted, you know, MI5 assets. Well, it's not accidental, right? I mean, these are the people who are behind these groups, and they're BFF with Saudi Arabia. That's why Saudi Arabia never gets in trouble. Nobody ever goes after them. You know, Hillary Clinton writes these op-ed pieces about how she's concerned about, you know, the rights of individuals and under Assad's government. Why she's never talked about Saudi Arabia? I wonder why, right? What about the rights of anybody living in Israel? Right? This is never mentioned. It's always the target nations that are the hotbed for where we need to, quote, bring democracy. So I'm rambling, but you get the idea. Tony Cartolucci talks about Telegraph articles from a long time ago where U.S. taxpayer money was going into funding these operations in Libya and in Syria. France plays a big role in this. Sarkozy was talking about the removal of Assad for a long time. And so you have kind of this Saudi, London, France, all of these usual suspect scumbag governments all on board with Hillary's plan, right? And this is why we talk about Atlantis's power blocks, because it's real. You get all of these people, one big gang of thieves trying to divvy up the resources of these areas. That's what a lot of this is about. So, you know, France is big in arming these quote, rebel groups. And it's great how they just remodel these things, right? I mean, when Al-Qaeda attacks the Pentagon or the World Trade Center, they're terrorist groups. When they fight Assad, they're freedom fighters, right? When the Mujahideen fights the Soviet Union, they're freedom fighters. A terror attack happens, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are terror groups, right? So it's always just branded in some Orwellian doublethink way. And it's all just blatant. That's what's so crazy about it is how blatant it is. And then you get, interestingly, I'm not a big follower of the Christian Science Monitor, but they were apparently running a lot of pieces that were about removing Assad. So you've got these, again, a lot of these CIA, NGO type fake journalists, you know, embedded in all these places, running and writing all the propaganda, echoing Hillary, echoing John Kerry, echoing Bush, and of course Obama follows along perfectly with all this. And then we got sanctions put in on Assad. The sanctions were intended, obviously, as an act of warfare. The CFR ran pieces, as I've pointed out many times, saying that there's one famous piece called The Specter of Al-Qaeda in Syria. I deal with that in the video that I made that you are talking about. And it just openly calls for, I think it was 2012. We got to have more Al-Qaeda in Syria to remove Assad.
Yeah, that was the document that Michael Flynn, I think, talked about, right? The DIA, head of DIA.
When he talked about arming the rebels and terrorist groups?
Yeah.
On Fox?
He said that we look forward to an Islamic fundamentalist Salafist entity developing in Iraq and in Syria, because that would be used to advance U.S. interest, U.S. NATO interests.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get ISIS. Coincidence?
No. McCain in 2011 pledged $25 million to the removal of Assad. So if you wonder why he flew over there to meet with those guys, that's why. That's what he was doing. And he's BFF with Hillary on all this. See, so there's your transcends the GOP gobbledygook Democrat Party crap. Now, interestingly, too, of course, you and I know that legalities aren't really they don't matter for the people at that government level who are above law and at the corporate, super corporate level. But it is illegal, according to, U.S. and whatever international law is. Right. It's illegal to support terror groups. Right.
Yeah.
On paper, unless you are the State Department, you see. So this is where we get all of the scandal of Benghazi and Hillary. And I do believe that if you watch those George Webb videos, I think he makes a lot of really good, insightful connections. And I would agree with every point he makes in his Where Is Eric Braverman series. But he is connecting a lot of dots that are spot on. Excuse me. One of those was what exactly, the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's role as State Department was in Benghazi and why that was such a big deal and how they were using that as the platform to move on to the next stage, right? We think back to 2010 and Kissinger going on and doing interviews. You can still pull some of these up on YouTube where he says, "This is the first act in a play. You will see the second and third act of the play." Right, where so he's some of the removal of Mubarak. He says, "This is the first act of a play." And he says, "You will see the second and third acts of this play." And that was an interview, a video interview that he did back in 2010. So we know that this was all planned out. And interesting, too, you start to notice a lot of the names of the groups are very shady. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a quote jihad group, and then there's also a Syrian Islamic Fighting Group, I believe.
Wasn't the Libyan group led by a guy who at one time was detained and tortured as a terrorist?
Belhaj?
Yeah.
Yes, Belhaj is, then he goes and runs the operations, some of the operations in Syria. But yeah, once you look at that guy who was supposed to be the head of all the Free Syrian Army operations, General Idris, I just went blank, but he's the guy that McCain's meeting with in those pictures. Mm-hmm. But so what's interesting next is that McCain calls for more airstrikes. They try to use some drone operations, but the drone operations look bad on the media. Media-wise, people are starting to catch on to the drones, so what they do is they start running these stories. Hillary writes more op-eds saying, I think that we are trying to build an international coalition, and if Assad thinks that his people are being attacked by, basically she said that he's wrong, he's attacking his people, it's not foreign powers, that's what she says. But it most certainly is foreign powers, and that's what's key here. And then you realize that the Brookings...
They're mercenaries.
Exactly. Yeah. And it starts to look like, so they're divvying up these places into microstates. And that was the Brzezinski model of a long time ago. He said we need microstates in these regions. It's also the Oded Yanan plan of Israel. Mm-hmm. We need microstates. Now, I'm not saying that Brzezinski's, he's obviously he's interestingly not pro-Israel. He's oftentimes making Israel mad, but when it comes to the bigger global picture, he's obviously on board with a lot of these plans. So Brookings Institute in 2012 writes a piece calling for the removal of Assad, I think.
What's amazing?
So I made a note. Yeah, here it is. Here it is. Yeah.
How casual Brookings they are Institute. About,
yeah. Exactly. saving Syria, assessing the options for the regime change, and that's a 2012 Brookings Institute piece. All of these things are still online. You just go read them, and they talk about what they're going to do, and then, they do it.
Was it Carol Quigley who wrote about this sort of false consensus that's confected by through the CFR, through their through journalists, various mm-hmm. politicians? So it gives the appearance of sort of this broad consensus of from a variety of sources, leading people to conclude that this must be the right policy because so many different people agree with it. But it's really, it's being all coordinated from the Senate, from the CFR.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Was it he who wrote about that process?
I'm trying to remember. There may be a spot in Treasury Note where he talks about creating the consensus. I can't recall off the top of my head, but
that's how it's done. I mean, obviously, all these people, it's being coordinated, and like you mentioned, all these so-called journalists there.
Well, that's who plays the key role here. Yeah. Is if CNN is not the one reporting that Assad's killing his people and using sarin gas and all this nonsense, none of this would work.
Well, I mean, look at like a journal like Foreign Affairs, right? It's supposed to be the mm-hmm. scholarly journal about how the world should be run. But really, Foreign Affairs just it's a propaganda organ mm-hmm. for the financial elite, for Western corporations, Wall Street,
absolutely,
banking, big oil, these things. So it's all propaganda that's given
the only use that it has is when you come across these memos where they just say what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Right. So in other words, if you've kind of got hip to this, then you can recognize that when they write a piece a year ahead of time saying, we just got to have international order in Libya, we've got to, fix things there, that means they're going to have a regime change there. Yeah. So that's how you predict the future. But, they even laid out, Michael O'Hanlon laid out the military measures for how to get rid of Assad through punitive naval and air operations to encourage coups, broader Balkans-like campaigns to help depose Assad, admitting, by the way, that they led then all these Balkan campaigns.
So what he's proposing is, let's wage low-grade warfare, blow up mm-hmm. a few towns, kill a lot of people. This caused suffering for hundreds of thousands, not millions of people, create a crisis, ruin the lives of millions of people so they can achieve some sort of geopolitical, economic objective.
Yeah, and say that it's the fault of the existing regime, and then you offer the solution of your baloney where all of your generals and your contractors and Clinton Foundation and GOP scumbags have all basically just thrown their money into this pot, and they're going to get some sort of kickback or corporate deal when you go in there, right? Like Biden's son, getting oil deals in Ukraine.
And Wesley Clark and Albright cashing in on the Balkans there.
Exactly.
This is
the exact model, and this is how the whole thing runs. So once you see the kind of this architecture of this giant onion ring of scam, and it's mind-boggling. It's like only the devil could have come up with this mind-boggling scheme of like just webs of deceit within webs of deceit within webs of deceit. But then, and you think, well, could it really be like that? And then you think, well, it's all out here in the open. Like they have all these memos just saying what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a business plan.
Exactly. There you go.
And you can create, and if you disrupt these areas, you create arenas for the drug trade, the arms shipment, human trafficking. Because if you create misery, you create human trafficking. Because people become desperate. You know what happens? Their daughters are sold off.
Yes, and by the way, it's General Salim Idris, IDRISS, okay, is who I was thinking of. He's this sort of CIA general there that's running the Free Syrian operations, but the buddies with McCain. But once you understand that the preparations for all this goes back to 2005, 2009, 2010. And there, by the way, there were also WikiLeaks cables that discussed this, operations that they would run. I'm not saying that means WikiLeaks is necessarily good, but I think that, you know, when you see a cable like that, it's real. You know, that is a real cable. It is a real operation that we're running. And then you'll notice, you know, the red flags, like anytime you see things like human rights, XYZ, human rights, blah, 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 right? Or human rights and labor, this is a CIA front. And then, as we said, the National Democratic Initiative, International Republican Institute, National Endowment for Democracy, all this stuff, this is who, you know, causes your agitation, causes your regime change. And I should add, too, once you understand, too, the neoconservative model, that's why I also included, I think in that talk or one of the more recent talks I did, a discussion of the neoconservative policy and general philosophy and approach, which is a very curious blend of Nietzscheanism, will to power, pragmatism with the Trotskyite model of terror. So yeah, when you understand that, it makes perfect sense that the neocons are the terrorists. They really are. I mean,
perpetual revolution.
Perpetual revolution, perpetual tension, perpetual warfare, perpetual terror. This is why the news constantly puts you in a state of fear about terror attacks.
And also lying, BS stories, propaganda, because that goes to the noble lie, Leo Strauss.
I was going to say Leo Strauss, right, which is a very Nietzschean approach to all this.
Leo Strauss studied under Carl Schmitt, who was the legal theorist for the Third Reich, National Socialism.
Yes.
So you have all these Jew neocons worshiping Leo Strauss, whose guru
theorist. They do like the successes of techniques of Nazi propaganda, right?
Yeah, and that's why there's always been a symbiotic relationship
there. That's what I was going to say, the symbiotic relationship, and if you approach these things from a scientific standpoint, you're interested in what works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who cares what the National Socialist ideology was if we can study whether, you know, their model of propaganda and advertising, compare it with Trotsky's model of propaganda and advertising. And that's why you saw so many similarities, you know, with a Nazi poster versus a Trotskyite poster, a Bolshevik poster. It's like the exact same artwork, the exact same poster. You just, instead of the Aryan family, stick in the worker family.
Yeah, exactly. And you also have, you know, Chris, with the if you look at something like the Third Reich itself and the Nazi phenomenon was a reaction to the decadent Weimar Republic, mm-hmm. a lot of Jewish influence there, Jewish finance, and also the Versailles Treaty. And that goes back to the broader plan to destabilize and weaken Germany, which goes back to this Anglo
absolutely
Kinderdog.
Yeah, exactly. Which is like what Quigley admits, what Friedman at Stratford even talks about. So
which is still in play today, apparently.
It absolutely is in play. That's what we're still living through, the latter stages of this. And so, looking back at my notes, as Brandon Turbeville, I'm going to give him credit in his book for pointing out, it's the death squads that we saw in El Salvador, it's the death squads and operations in Honduras that actually Frederick P. Hitz, who has some role with the CIA, I forget what, but he did a report actually on CIA for the CIA, if I recall, about the CIA operations in Honduras and how those black ops were run and so forth. And what you start to notice is that pattern of that you can. These are kind of the death squad / the real terrorist operation that goes in. They're actually the ones that are running the black mark. The what am I trying to say? The black op, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, even though Brandon doesn't mention it, I think based on what Doug Valentine talks about, I think Phoenix program is related to that.
Yeah, the Phoenix program, Vietnam, the whole thing in Vietnam was like, I think it was, at least part of it was a big test.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's also being applied here, and I think he's correct with the fusion centers. And it's the same plan. And his study of the Phoenix program, the way he did it was he's one of the few people who understands its totality because it was so compartmentalized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That he was, because of his relationship with Colby, and how he initially got in there and got to talk to all these people who are running different parts of the program, their little parts of it.
Yes.
He got to see the wider picture of it. The big picture of what really was going on. And then he can go back and then look at its application in these other areas. You do see it with the Salvador option and John Negroponte. Then of course we see
exactly Negroponte is a key. He's a key character because he's in Iraq. I think
who's that guy Ford? Named Ford that
yes.
So called ambassador.
I believe Brandon Turnbull talks about Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Negroponte.
Their job is like the spirit. It's like that insurance ad, Mayhem.
That's what Ford is working with Negroponte at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Is how that's working. And it's Newsweek in 2005 that reported that what's happening in Baghdad will be a base for operations being moved, Black Op operations being moved to Syria. If you read the 2005 Newsweek piece.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're spot on there. That's exactly how it is. And I just thought it was, and this is me speculating. I'm saying I bet that the stuff that's in the Phoenix program ties into it too, because it's terror, right? And if Dave McGowan's right, you know, that's just the application of some of those ideas domestically. If you want to sum it all up, it's basically all just studies in terror.
Well, psychological warfare.
Psychological warfare. Yeah.
And of course, with that, you get people like characters like Michael Aquino, who did psy warfare doctrine working in Vietnam, which you have to think he was involved in Phoenix.
It would make sense, yeah. And especially when he's writing all these open papers about mind war, psy war, and all this stuff. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so Brandon Turnbull does talk about the death squads and the Belhaj character and all of this being run from the Gulf states, that's who's putting the money up, basically. The UK Foreign Office, Saudis, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and then the weapons and this kind of stuff comes from Turkey. From those places, money and weapons into Turkey, and then from Turkey into Syria. So, I mean, it's just amazing that it's all charted out. And even back in 2011 and 12, the New York Times was even writing pieces. Admitting that the CIA was backing this stuff.
Well, this is how you clear out an area, I mean, terrorize an area, keep it from developing. I mean, I was listening to Patrick Henningsen did an interview last week with this Syrian American, and he was talking about what Syria was like before 2011, and he was talking about how they manufactured their own clothes, they had no foreign debt. They're outside the central banking, system of the globe, the Western central banking system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might have been the problem. So you go in to destroy a country, guess what? They can go in with the World Bank and rebuild it with debt. It's usury, right?
Absolutely. And, Cy Hirsch's article, The Redirection, is really good. It laid a lot of this out. Of course, I kind of think that Cy Hirsch will... He doesn't always tell the full story.
he has the sources. I mean, they have sources.
Yeah. You have to limit it, yeah.
Doug Valentine calls him CIA more Hirsch.
Yep. No. That's what I've been thinking for a while. Because you won't get the information. It's a point Patrick made to me a long time ago. He's like, if you say too much, you'll lose all your sources.
Yeah.
So. But you can read those pieces.
Yes.
And even though they're little windows into parts of the program, if you read enough windows and parts of the operation, you can start to put the pieces together and start to figure it out. And that's what I've been at least attempting to do. So And I have to stress too, because it's becoming more and more important, is the internet's role. And that's what I just love this title: swarming mobs of adolescents. It just sounds hilarious, but I came across that Rand Corporation paper actually a few months ago, and I even then, before I'd interviewed Andrew, I hadn't put that piece together. Like, because I'd heard people talk about swarming. I'm like, it's warfare. What are you talking about? Oh, they're actually talking about creating a mob.
Well, that's right? Funny because...
And this is what Soros does with his rent-a-mob.
Yeah, Bill Engdahl theorized that's what happened in France as early as 1968. Swarming.
Oh, really?
Because the student riots in 68 that we all hear about?
Yes, yeah.
I was too young to remember it, but, you know, it's sort of these riots. This was right when de Gaulle was challenging the dollar. And one was demanding redemption, and he was challenging the Bretton Woods system and trying to hold.
And this is why the West got mad at de Gaulle, right?
De Gaulle, and then all of a sudden, lo and behold, there are these student revolts, and they said that was an idea concocted by Rand. They called them swarming techniques. Now technology wasn't there with Twitter,
yes,
and social media, but it's the same thing. Just and within a year, he was out of power, and France was no longer challenging. Demanding redemption, and Nixon was able to close the gold window and usher in the petrodollar. So
that does make sense. And now that I think about it, you're right, because in Full Spectrum Dominance, which he wrote in like 2009, he has a section on the swarming model. So absolutely,
yeah.
But I forgot about the de Gaulle part.
And I mean, we also see that I think in Iran, right, when they had the rent-a-mobs. The false riots and the
Green Revolution in Iran.
No, I'm talking about in 50 when they.
Oh, back to Mossadegh. Right, yes,
but the Green Revolution would be an example of that too. But they remember the video of the girl getting shot.
Yes, I do. Yes, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's an example where Mossadegh was overthrown because he was ran afoul of Western royal interests, and then Shah was installed, and the Shah's
then he expired. Yeah.
He expired, and you have. Khomeini, who's cooling his heels in France,
Yes, I've talked many times about that guy being a dubious character. But if you read Stephen Dorrell's book, he even says that the next couple, or I can't remember if this is Ayatollah Khashoggi, I believe, or Khashoggi, one of these, not Khashoggi, the Ayatollah Khashoggi, I believe is his name. One of the guys that succeeded the Shah was also already bought off by MI6 or somebody. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think Dreyfus says that too in his book.
Yeah, that whole thing, Chase Manhattan Beck, came out smelling like a rose.
Yes, I remember you mentioning that first, and then what was I reading? Was it maybe Engdahl? But somebody went into that whole thing about the Chase Bank aspect of the Shah and all that.
And it was Kissinger, I think, convinced Carter to take in the Shah.
Yes.
And Kissinger was always has always been a Rockefeller guy. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Totally. No. Who talks about that? No, because I can't remember where I was just reading it. I heard you talk about it.
Bill
like
Engdahl,
months ago.
The Collins
it's Engdahl,
brothers.
That's it.
Engdahl, yeah. Also, I've talked to the Collins brothers about too.
Okay.
They got this. They got to keep.
Oh, so it's in Full Spectrum Dominance. That's where it is.
Okay, that's where it is. Okay. Yeah. So, again, when you look at these things, there are different levels.
Exactly.
Layers of intrigue, and it's hard to get a full picture. To what extent we're being played? We're watching a drama unfold, a script or something being played out.
Well, I think it's that way because they know what's an effective plan. Because it's worked many times, and they just keep running the same plan.
Yeah. So that also coincided with the Iranian Revolution is the winding down of the Cold War, which the Cold War was as confected as I think it was at the top level, managed. They could see they needed the war on terror, and you really see that starting in the late 70s with that 1979 conference in Israel with Benjamin Netanyahu, and Bush was there, and this is with the Safari Club, and
yes,
yeah.
Is this the when I interviewed Gould and Fitzgerald, they referenced some obscure conference like that that they talk about also kind of kicks off the war on terror. And they said Brzezinski was at it, and it was like a big
big conference. And so they're planning the next phase. And this, you know,
exactly.
It only stands to figure it would occur 15, 20 years before. But then we see it played out gradually with certain events. I mean, the hijacking and all that stuff, which if you listen to people like
Your last interview.
Yeah, that and Ostrovsky, who's, you know, by way of deception.
Mossad, yeah.
The Mossad. Right. A lot of these operations like the Achille Lauro were Mossad operations. I mean, they were Islamic radicals pulling them off, but their strings were being pulled by Mossad agents.
Yeah, and who was writing the fiction to prepare the world for this secret of war and terror? Ian Fleming. So yeah, like even in the Cold War, he's writing about international terror villains. Right?
Yeah. So
that are beyond government, by the way.
Yeah.
So they're transnational, supernova. But yeah, we've gone to that many times. But
yeah, George.
So
Webb,
yeah, so
that guy George Webb, you mentioned him.
Uh huh.
He talked. Apparently, there is an email regarding in some of these WikiLeaks with Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
There was gotten into trouble, and this is what he thinks that Braverman was upset about, was she was hiring mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding Libya, from the Libyan takedown.
Yes.
And it was $9 billion in gold.
Yes, I did see all that, right.
So she's money's, I guess, being donated to the Clinton Foundation for her mm-hmm. to facilitate this, the arms yep. shipments, because she's in a position to sign the waivers to get, you know, to grease the skids, to approve these things. I mean, she's basically distilling gold for somebody, probably for Chase Manhattan Bank or something.
Yeah, and all of her donors that are probably going to get these kickbacks.
Yeah.
Would be my suspicion. And that actually does make sense with this. Let me read this great Tony Cartolucci quote from back from 2012. He says, the Brookings Institute issued a report called Libya's Test of the International Order, which argued for intervention in Libya, describing the undertaking as a test of the international community, which it has to pass. failure to pass this test, in the words of the Brookings Institute's Doha Center, writes, will shake the faith of the people in the region, in the emerging international order, in the primacy of international law, in other words, the New World Order. The report states, quote, demonstrably, it must draw a line in the sand to deter the other Arab autocrats who resort to attacking their people rather than dialoguing with them through genuine reforms. By these reforms, the Brookings Institute is referring to Libya's integration into the international system, where protectionist economic policies would be pushed aside to allow foreign governments and multinational corporations to usurp the country's sovereignty and natural resources. And guess what? If you go read that Brookings Institute report, it says they must freeze Gaddafi's assets. So George Webb, I think, is onto something in those mm-hmm. videos, because he talks about the freezing of the assets. And yeah.
Now, of course.
Is it $9 billion? I don't know how much gold it is.
I thought it was $9 billion. Yeah. Now, another term, they're stealing these assets. And that also goes, remember the Iranian, the seizure of the U.S. embassy?
The 1979, yeah.
Yeah, the freezing of Iranian assets, right?
Oh, good point.
Because you don't want the Shah withdrawing those assets from Chase Manhattan Bank.
Well, yeah, you might spirit them away to some other place, and you have to go to that place, right?
And you know, and if you had strong Arab states, they might like form a consortium of their own banking system.
Right, and no one ever seems to freeze the assets and attack Switzerland and its banks, right?
No.
Like, that's not anything we're going to see anytime soon, but because all the global oligarchs have money there. But
one thing I thought was interesting in your talk, you talked about the, of course, the drug networks, how vital this is. That, of course, it serves a key thing with intelligence. We've seen in all cases, like in Burma in the late 40s, in Vietnam, how the Vietnam War, you could look at the Vietnam War as at least the early phases, the CIA pushing out the French.
Yeah, I remember you pointing that out. And I understand that now, right? The French, the British, and then the French, right?
Yeah, the Corsicans. And now, in each phase, drugs play a key role in financing these operations, financing the arms. You have the Hmong tribes people. You have the mountain people in Burma. And now you also, in the Balkans, you have this the Albanians, which has now become a capital for crime, and also the Albanian the Albanian diaspora.
They run the drugs back into the other countries like the U.S., right?
And human trafficking, which plays a big role in this, because if you are trying to suborn or bribe foreign officials, maybe you say some Saudi princes who are into little girls, you want to be able to supply that, and the Albanian criminal networks will be in a position to supply those.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe... I reference it a lot, but Shadow Masters actually, I think, has a section on the Turkish networks and mobs as well as the Albanian. And he, Esalen does talk about the Albanians running the things that you're talking about.
And the one way you get a lot of, potential sex slaves is if you go in and just screw up a country, destroy its economy, make everyone desperate, kill families.
Well, it was the CIA forces. It was the West that was supporting the communists in Albania.
Yes.
Admittedly. So, yes. So that allows regime change, destabilization, these scumbags to come to power, who presumably are at the behest of Western powers covertly.
Mm-hmm. And there's some suggestion that the drug trade might have factored into the death of Princess Grace.
Yes, that is Esalen's thesis, right? Yeah,
because Monaco is not just gambling, but it's like Las Vegas, right?
Yeah, a lot of black market stuff. And I believe he connects it to diamonds and the diamond smuggling stuff and perhaps Jewish interests that might be involved in the black market jewel trade.
Mm-hmm.
Because one way, by the way, that if you have a lot of, say, drug money that you don't want to, that you want to put into a liquid form or transport the money, diamonds is, of course, a sort of a classic easy way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because diamonds are worth a lot and they're small and you can hide them it's a way to move a large amount of money.
Yeah, and you know how to, if you have to, you can liquidate it quickly because you know who to call.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I think the big takeaway here is that if you're listening to this and you're trying to maybe, step into this, put your foot in the puddle and get into this kind of stuff. Once you get a picture of kind of the patterns, I think it all kind of falls into place. You see the same techniques, the same strategies, the same models. They all coalesce. It's it's everything that Tony Cartolucci writes about. It's everything that Brendan Turbeville talks about. It's everything that's in Andrew Kriegko's articles about asymmetrical warfare. I'm not saying I agree with all those guys on all those points either, but I think they are painting the accurate picture that you're not going to get from CNN or Fox on any of this stuff.
Well, that's when we get into fake news and perception management, which you write a lot about, you talk a lot about. None of this dimension or depth is ever discussed in the news media. It's
yes, complete BS. Intentionally kept on a very, very... good guy, bad guy, very, very, sixth grade level type stuff.
Yeah.
Number one, just because people aren't going to listen. Millions of people are not going to listen to the conversations you and I are having. Maybe one day they will, but at this point in time, they're not going to, which, if they were healthy, functioning adults, they should be, I think, listening to the kind of conversation we're having. But no, it's got to be this very dumbed down. And then that goes into the whole Charlotte Isherbit and John DeVergato and how the education system has been very effective as a weaponized thing. And
well, how else do you explain something as sinister as this proxy war in Syria that the U.S., NATO, Western powers have been waging for the past 6 years and getting away with it, and the people who are doing it aren't being locked up, because people just don't bother to listen to the details and draw the proper inferences from what the evidence is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is Emmanuel Goldstein. It really is this shady terror guy who, in the novel doesn't even exist.
Well, like, who is John Kerry or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, for that matter, to declare that Assad must go? By what authority? Who commissioned them?
I'll tell you who. Skull and Bones Authority.
That's what it gets back to. Yeah, because it gets back to drugs. Right. Yeah. And, drug networks. And you can't separate the drugs from the intelligence agencies because that's where they came from.
Yes. And, in fact, I hesitate to recommend this person because there's a lot of goofy, wacky stuff. But I will say, I do admit that if you read Bloodlines of the Illuminati, and if you filter out his, I don't buy a lot of what he talks about, like in his later books about all this sort of wacky stuff that's a little too out there. But he will hit on stuff that nobody else has hit on, and he's hit on stuff ahead of time that nobody's ever talked about. So again, I'm not advocating his whole body of work, but I do think he's onto a lot of stuff because he was, you know, in the 90s he was writing this book based on Sutton's books and on Carol Quigley and I like that I give him credit for tying in the occult angle. I think John Todd is a scam artist, so I don't buy his support for I think he would have been a lot better as a researcher if he didn't immediately accept somebody coming to him and saying they have a story. But if you look at filter that kind of stuff out, I think he does a very good picture of tying in how all of these things do relate to bloodlines. They do relate to prominent families. And, you know, that's who's in the background of these institutions like the Fabian Socialists and, you know, the section that he did on the Astors, I was amazed because it was actually everything that I had read in Tragedy and Hope. You know, it's all laid out there. So he's absolutely right about what he says about the Carnegie Endowment, the Astors, and
of course you're talking about Fritz Springmeier.
Yes. So I recommend that book with caveats and cautions because there is some goofy stuff in there. But like he'll say, for example, you know, most people aren't going to think about or talk about how AP and Reuters are controlled, right? But he will list, you know, this Robert Moore Collins character who was a member of the Pilgrim Society, and he is the point man for, you know, in the middle of AP and Reuters. And of course, if you know about the history of Reuters, you know, this is like a Rothschild run thing. So there's truth to a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah, and the way the Rothschilds organized was, you know, they set out the five brothers to go to the five major cities, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Another, he has a section on a certain General Wheeler who was running the Vietnam operation from the military side of things. And he talks about the Golden Triangle and the drugs. So, you know, the stuff that Chris Milligan, you know, that you and Chris talked about. That, you know, Fritz had actually, to be fair, mentioned that a long time ago. I was also appreciative of the fact that he did realize that I could not believe this. I have to say, he made this goofy claim. I was like, there's no way. He said Abraham Lincoln was a Rosicrucian. And I kid you not, if you go and look at the Lincoln archives, they have papers about him being a Rosicrucian. I couldn't believe it. I thought I knew all these, you know, I thought I was really deep into this. But that one surprised me. I have to admit, I was surprised to see that the Lincoln archives admit that he was at least interested in Rosicrucianism. So, you know, with reservation, I think another flaw in that book is that at times he will, he'll pick out people because they have the same last name, which doesn't always mean that you're part of that family, right?
Jones.
Right. I mean, how many people have that name, right? So,
but it's weird, as he appears to have been targeted for some reason.
Could have been. I don't know what to believe about this stuff.
Bank robbery charge? He doesn't seem to me as a bank robber.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I don't buy all this stuff about all this elaborate story about how MKUltra works and that, you know, like you say all the exact perfect trigger words to a person and you can deprogram them. And I don't buy all that. I mean, I'm not saying there's not trigger words and that wasn't a real program. I'm just saying the flaw in his methodology, I think, is to accept that a person who comes to you and says, I'm exposing the Illuminati, that they, you know, there are a lot of people in independent media claiming to have been the Illuminati who I think are full of it.
Yeah, you have to be very, very careful and skeptical. And I'm sorry if you are an actual victim of these things, but just because you tell me you're a victim doesn't mean I'm
exactly. Yeah.
What are we supposed to? How are we supposed to respond to someone like Kathy O'Brien?
Another one that was a surprise to me was when he talked about the Astors and the drug running and being high level Freemasons, and so. When I was watching The Goonies, I was sitting there watching this, you know, a month ago, and I was like, they're in Astoria, and that's named after the Astors. And so you go, this is public records. I found the public archives online, and you find out that the Astor Patriarch was like this high-level Mason. And yes, he was running the drugs. That's all true.
Yeah, and being a part of that Mason network would help you.
Exactly.
Ascend that power. That's part of the deal.
That's why I think if you're doing this kind of research or if you're hearing this stuff and you think, oh, I don't buy into that bloodline stuff. Well, even if you set aside the occult aspect of it, which I do actually do agree. In fact, I have been thinking more recently when you look at some of these Puritan families, and I've only seen a couple people that really posit this. What's her name? Dame Frances Yates posits that a lot of these Yale WASP Puritan, university Harvard types, like the older families, that they actually did bring some occultism with them and witchcraft. Now, I was kind of skeptical of that, but I actually think there's something to that because it's not accidental that you see Harvard University becoming Unitarian Universalist. And what does the Unitarian Universalist Church constantly promote? Witchcraft. Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised if there's not something to that thesis that some of these early Puritan families that they didn't actually bring witchcraft with them.
Well, it helps to demystify these things. And if you look at the occult and what it really represents, the occult is just secreted knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who has the benefit of inside information, secreted knowledge, is going to have an advantage. So whether that's financial or, you know, scientific principles or, you know, something an outfit like the Royal Society is there to control control mechanism, or you can weaponize it properly. You know, so, you know, that's why you want to, they say information is power, knowledge mm-hmm. is power. So if you control that knowledge and who has that knowledge, then you can have much more power.
Right. And in my general methodology, what I've done with a lot of these claims, in this kind of book is if I see a claim I want to check I'll go and double check it. And, you know, Google makes it very easy because, you know, there are all kinds of archives are online now, you know, mm-hmm. so you can easily see if the Astor Patriarch was a high level Freemason. Sure enough, he was. You know, you can look at Lincoln archives and see that, oh, yes, there is evidence that Abraham Lincoln was a Rosicrucian. And I mean, there's something to all this, and I'm not a New England scholar, so I don't know all the history of it. But you know that it's just not accidental that this is that's the birthplace of American Rosicrucianism. That's the birthplace of Unitarian Universalism. All these Unitarian groups are promoting witchcraft. Harvard offers witchcraft courses. I mean, come on. There's something to this, right? Yeah. And there is the belief for people who are serious about witchcraft and Wicca, and they believe it's generational. So there is a basis to believe in occult generational bloodlines. At least those people believe it.
Bloodlines in general matter. People have families, right? I mean, it's like you're going to network, and that's one of the best way to secure loyalty and reliability, whether it's running a restaurant or running a corporation or trying to run the world. You're going to intermarry and have networks mm-hmm. and you can create oaths and bonds between people. And
well, I just read the Bible and look at marriages between kings and stuff. Right? Yeah. I mean, this was political, and so absolutely. But it, also, when we think about power, power has often been connected to religion and theology, and it's really only been since the Enlightenment, since the advent of so-called scientific revolution, that we think in the West that there's no connection between, you know, the state and the gods. And, you know, we believe this myth of, you know, American, you know, freedom of religion and all this kind of stuff. And, but separation of church and state and so forth. But, you know, the more you dig into deep politics and this kind of stuff, you start to wonder if that's not just a facade for the masses to believe. And, you know, we start seeing things like Franklin cover up, and we see things like Savile, and you start to wonder if, you know, some of these people aren't really taking their Satanism or occultism or even worse practices like human sacrifice seriously. And I know that sounds so far out, but I mean, the kings in the Bible practice human sacrifice, right? The apostate kings do this.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a perennial practice of rulers. I don't see. I mean, we have the national sacrifice of abortion, so why should it be any more far-fetched?
Yeah, and you know, it's like, I think that we've progressed by that, past that, is people are naive. Look at the world wars. And just the utter senseless destruction and slaughter, the bombing, the firebombing of cities and these things. It made no sense strategically, just utter destruction. You can look at that as sort of a huge sacrifice.
Well, I know a lot about Calvinism, and I've just always found it odd that this, if you look at the Eastern establishment WASP elite, which descend from these Puritans, why do you have this transition period in the history of like the Congregationalists and these kind of people, the Harvard, Yale types, these families, they transition. You have this period, what's called the New Light Presbyterians, and they start taking this more charismatic style approach. And if I recall, I think Jonathan Edwards eventually got caught up in this movement, and he started thinking that you kind of had these direct revelations, and then you had the Quakers, and the Quakers have all these really bizarre connections. And I don't think it's accidental that Richard Nixon's a Quaker. I don't think he was just a homegrown organic person there. There had to be something going on there, but it's just, and again, it's Dame Frances Yates actually does document some of the prominent Harvard people. I think it was the first president of Harvard was some sort of alchemist or occultist of some flavor. I forget her exact quote, but she has a whole book on it. And, you know, she's like the most renowned Oxford or Cambridge English Renaissance scholar. So I don't think she's making this up, especially if you've read her book, Rosicrucian Enlightenment. She talks about how the Enlightenment was actually a manifestation of Rosicrucian philosophy out of German secret lodges prior to the Enlightenment. So this is characters like Johann von Andre, Christian somebody, I forget all the names, but some have alleged, you know, Luther's involvement perhaps in this. I think it's hard to demonstrate that. Maybe you and I have touched on this, I can't remember, but I don't think it's accidental that you have the German lodges of Rosicrucianism that give rise to the Enlightenment. And I believe that she totally proves that thesis.
Yes, and same way the lodges in France play a big key role in there.
Absolutely. Revolution. Absolutely.
That's part of it. And that might have been an extension of Whig foreign policy. British exploiting the Freemasonry, which I guess took over the early 18th century, like 1700 or 1717, when the British Freemasonry took hold. And that's when you had this lodge system. And again, demystified, this is a technology that's used for suborning and subversion and, you know, engaging in high criminality and malfeasance and sort of networking. And you're going to, you know, secret handshakes and oaths and stuff, and you're going to etherealize it with maybe with certain practices and smoke and mirrors, I guess you could say, and this will attract a lot of people. And so, you know, that's, you know, you're taking on a religious aura to it, just to make sure people, respect it. You know, same way that that churches have, you know, certain practices. You know.
Yes, but I also believe that even amongst, if you look at the satanic ritual abuse type stuff, And even what traditional Catholic writers have written, William Kennedy's book, or Craig Heinbichner when he was still traditional Catholic's book, or Hoffman talks about it in his books, or you look at what Malachi Martin's written. You know, when you look at the Catholic angle of it, I think that you do have some of these people who really do believe in Satanism.
Definitely.
I'm not just singling out Catholics. I mean, I'm saying Saville too, and Aquino, and any of these characters.
Yeah, and when you talk about Catholicism, Chris, there's always the concern to what extent that the Vatican has been infiltrated, because you have these lodges, you know, the P2 Lodge, and also, you know, even the whole idea of the history of the centralization of the Italian state in the 19th century, if I remember, was done under Freemasonic auspices.
It was. The Italian Revolution was Masonic.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that's who the Masons are, who had Pius IX walled up in the Vatican.
Yeah.
he couldn't leave. They threatened to kill him.
And so the Catholic Church used to stress a lot about the problem of Freemasonry.
Absolutely. And by the way, interesting, I researched this several years ago, and I can't remember what my source is. I usually can remember a source, but the story about Pius IX is apparently true, that when he was younger, he had kind of Republican liberal leanings. And once he was walled up in the Vatican, he changed his mind. he saw, you know, where these revolutionaries ended up. And so the story goes, at least that's part of what prompted Vatican I.
Yeah, that's right. That was 1870, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, I guess, 20 years later, you have Leo the 13th with his encyclical.
Correct.
Roughly.
There's a famous movie. I saw it so many years ago. I think it's an Italian film, famous movie. Set in the time period, and it actually mentions the Italian revolutionaries being Masonic.
Yeah, Garibaldi and...
Yes. But I was surprised to see that in a movie, and I can't remember what, something from the 60s. Maybe it has Sophia Loren in it, but I can't remember.
Yeah, of course.
Older movie.
What we call the mafia.
Exactly.
That's all along Masonic lines.
Correct, right. P2, absolutely.
Yeah. And this goes back to what Patrick Henningsen talked about, the Vinosa Vanessa Bealey write about, with these NGOs, whether it's the White Helmets or some of the offices. This is the P2 Lodge. It's a way to set up a parallel or shadow government.
Interesting. Yes. And I haven't totally tracked all that down, but as I think of the first interview you and I did, it ties into NATO, and it ties into the recruitment of neo-fascists in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you get NATO using the far right in Europe.
Yeah, they go after the left, and also to create the strategy of tension, terror. This goes back to El Salvador option, Negroponte.
That is not to say, by the way, that NATO is a far right organization. They're not. because they're the ones that are also part of the EU. And they're promoting
the dialectic, right?
Exactly, right.
I mean, it's why is NATO? I'm looking at Syria, North Syria in Europe, is it North Atlantic? Why is NATO involved in Syria? why is Turkey in NATO? That's all. You get out of the Cold War and all that stuff, but that's always been an odd. And of course, no one wants Turkey in the EU because it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense, first of all. There was a great article by Leonid Savin or Dugin or somebody pointing out that Turkey is a Eastern country. It doesn't make sense, and it's not Europe. So yeah,
it's not Europe. Russia is a better fit for Europe than Turkey.
Right.
I think another where we're getting into all that destabilization. Of course, we mentioned Europe is causing this migration crisis, which is solving could serve lots of agendas. I was listening to Bill Engdahl talking about what the Trump presidency may represent, and he seems to think that Trump, either wittingly or unwittingly, is being set up for World War III, because Trump will revitalize the industrial base of the United States, will enable the West to wage war against China and Russia. And right now, Trump is set up to play the Russia card against China, the same way that Nixon played the China card against Russia in the 70s.
Yeah, I'm not convinced of that. I mean, it could. Obviously, he's a person who's done this a lot longer than me, yeah. But I don't buy that China's a real enemy of the West. I just can't really find strong proof of that.
I think what he thinks, he says what happens is what the West is trying to do, what the Anglo-American Empire is trying to prevent is sort of this Russia-China Central Asia, maybe even Europe's condominium. Because if you look at it economically, with China's factories that the Rockefellers built, mm-hmm. Russia's mm-hmm. resources, mm-hmm. and Europe's technical know-how, the odd man out is the U.S. empire mm-hmm. in that situation.
So what you could have here in this regard is...
It's Mackinder.
what I was going to say is you could also have a level of this where it's... There are a lot of U.S.-based interests mm-hmm. who do not like the more globalist-minded interests.
Yes.
So you have a lot of corporate power and a lot of money that is U.S.-based that still probably, in a way, wants to resist globalization and the movement of things mm-hmm. eastward. And you have a lot of globalist interests who don't like, I mean, they have an ideology, right? They have a more radical globalist ideology, right? And that's not to say that the corporate interests that might be U.S.-based are necessarily patriotic. They're not patriotic. They're money patriots.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, globalization will be bad for a lot of people is the point.
I was listening to a talk today about Nixon and the Watergate thing and what Nixon represented. And I was just thinking about the whole the Watergate thing, what was really going on. The one level of that is, of course, you have the limited hangout the Washington Post reported, which is probably all fake. Nixon was set up mm-hmm. by the CIA to take a fall. And why was he clashed with the CIA over the Bay of Pigs thing, which read the Kennedy assassination. That's one of the things that Nixon was prodding Richard Helms to turn over all the documents. And Richard Helms, interesting enough, didn't concede to that order. Shows you who's
right.
Got the power in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the whole Watergate phase, and this might be at the meta level, is okay. Nixon becomes president in 1969. He's reelected in 72. That's when Kissinger starts, the year before that, Kissinger has this diplomacy to China. This is the opening of China. And this is
right.
Kissinger works for the Rockefellers. And this is part of
David had already prepared the way for that to happen.
yeah. That's the whole Mao phase, right?
Yes, right.
The upheaval of China. You had to destroy China in order to rebuild it, right?
Mao is a great man.
They create all these traumatized, desperate people to work in the factories. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about what's going on around the world, but disrupting countries so you have drug arenas for the drug trade, arms shipments, and cheap labor, and sex trade.
But also create a sweatshop, worker, right?
And so Nixon Agnew win re-election 72.
Well, by the way, you have an analog to that. I don't mean to cut you off, but it just occurred to me when there are no local businesses, but everyone has to go work at a giant Amazon shipping center.
Yes.
Exactly. Okay. Go ahead.
And you may think you're getting low prices every day at Walmart, but the mm-hmm. price of that is the destruction of your local community, real economic opportunity, because real opportunity comes with small, mid-sized businesses and all. That's the whole model there. That's the whole But what's funny thing is Nixon Agnew get reelected in 72 overwhelmingly. Within a year, Agnew's chased out of office for this bribery scandal, which any governor could get charged on. Who gets brought in as vice president? Nelson Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then Watergate occurs, then Nixon is nudged out of office, and Ford becomes president. Of course, Ford was on the Warren Commission report, and Ford is vice president. Of course, right after he becomes president, Ford gets shot at two or three times. Who becomes president?
Interesting.
Nelson Rockefeller becomes president, right? Now that you see a plan there. And this is just speculation, but Nelson Rockefeller as vice president, from what I understand, played a very key role in getting fast-track trade authority passed to the Senate. Okay, as president of the Senate. That's the, you know, key role as vice president. And that's a big part in China's development.
Okay.
This whole trilateral scheme.
Cut his mustard or got his chops when he was running all the Central Latin American CIA ops.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's how he learned the big story here. Okay.
Yeah, controlling all those resources for our country, of course.
Yeah, right, for America. Yeah.
But, of course, then Nixon does his part by closing the gold window and, you know, separating gold, closing the gold window and bringing down Bretton Woods and imposing the petrodollar, because that enables, facilitates the debt and all the inflation, and also the strong dollar abroad, which leads to it creates the macro environment where the U.S. economy over the course of three decades is deindustrialized and all that is shipped east.
Which the petrodollar would be the Bilderberg plan fleshed out through OPEC.
Yes, with the OPEC, with that contrived war that Kissinger.
Yes.
According to Bill Engdahl. According to the documents.
Right. Documents.
And this also causes a 400% rise in the price of oil, which overnight turns all these exploration deals profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a vast source of credit for the federal government, so it can continue waging war and doing all the wonderful things that the government likes to do. At the same time, the dollar creates an environment where the petrodollar does is it subsidizes imports and makes exports more expensive for the U.S., which causes the deindustrialization.
Well, actually, I'd like to interview you in the second chunk of this. So what I want to start with is that very question, because I've heard you kind of talk about that topic a little bit on other interviews that you've done. And I'd like you to expand on that point and explain that, because that's something I don't really understand. So maybe we could close this part out and do a second part for my subscribers.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
Okay, well, Jay, I want to thank you for coming on the show. And of course, it's Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. His book is Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Films. It's a must-read to understand, how our perceptions are formed. Most of us see reality through films, through TV.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you want to expand on a little bit for it?
Yeah, so what I do is just I take that model of watching movies, and then I try to use that as a means by which you can educate yourself through film, actually. So it's intended to kind of be a fun way to approach learning things and waking people up, or friends, family member, whatever, through relatively short chapters that you can. What a lot of people have been telling me they're doing is like they're watching, you know, an old movie they haven't seen in 10 or 20 years and then reading that chapter.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And just kind of taking it, one a week or one every few days or whatever they want to do. And they find that to be a very educational approach. So that's why I think the book is valuable. I did put a lot of time and effort into it. And I think that it's a good read. It's beneficial for the newcomer as well as for the veteran. You'll learn something even if you know a lot about these topics, precisely because I try to bring other fields into it that may be new, like philosophy. A lot of people don't know about philosophy, so I try to bring Platonism into movies. Like who would think to do that? Well, I try to do that. So you're going to get philosophy, you're going to get some geopolitics, you're going to get some metaphysics, some esoteric type stuff, and just some crazy espionage Hollywood stories, some neat stuff like that. So if you would too, please purchase the book from me. That helps me as a writer much more so than getting it from Amazon. So I do sell the signed copies for $30 at Jay's Analysis. If you're outside the U.S., it does get a little bit more. Just email me and I'll work out a deal with you.
And you have like a troop of elves there that ship it out for you, right?
Yeah, the clockwork elves that you see when you do DMT, according to Joe Rogan, but I'm joking.
Okay, great. Okay.
Well, you will see things if you do hallucinogens, which I do not recommend. I'm not a proponent of any drugs, so I'm joking there.
Disclaimer. Okay. Well, okay, I'll let you go. Then we'll You can call me back. I'll take a break, and I'll
okay.
We'll chat again in a few minutes.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Great. Thanks.
The bad.